Well, again, I want to say a few things about two crucially important concepts, capitalism, democracy, which are have interesting relations, notably the relation of contradiction. And I want to talk a little about their prospects. Actually, I'm not going to talk about capitalism and democracy, contrary to what I just said, but rather about what we might call really existing capitalist democracy, which is something quite different. It's different from capitalism, different from democracy. RECD is the acronym, pronounced RECT for short, which is a good name for it. So let me talk about those and about their prospects. First of all, the difference between capitalist democracy and really existing capitalist democracy goes back to the first days of the founding of the Republic. The colonies were moving towards independence, they did get advice from the leading economists of the day, from Adam Smith, in fact, about the policies that they should pursue. And Adam Smith's advice should be familiar to us. It's approximately the same advice that's handed out today. The principle that he advised that the colonies should follow what's called sound economics. They should have free market principles, which means that the colonies should produce, should do what they're good at. It was an agricultural country. They should produce agricultural goods. Later, that was called their comparative advantage. Cotton, fur, fish, send them to the industrial centers in England, and they should import industrial goods from England, which are much more advanced. And then the argument is everybody benefits. The colonies were independent, and therefore they could make choices. And there was actually a division, like Thomas Jefferson would have agreed to this. He was a slave-owning aristocrat, a luxurious lifestyle based on agricultural production with slaves. He probably would have accepted it. But American economic policy was actually formulated by Alexander Hamilton, came from a different background, poor background, in fact. And he made a fateful decision. He decided to reject sound economics, reject capitalism, and to follow the path that England had followed, which was not free markets and not capitalism, rather to introduce a developmental state, extensive state intervention. So he immediately moved towards establishing very high protective tariffs to keep out superior British goods, just as Britain had instituted high tariffs and other means to keep out superior Indian goods, goods from the Low Countries and so on. The United States, in fact, became what one leading economist, economic historian, calls the mother country and bastion of protectionism, and stayed that way until the Second World War. Very high tariffs. By the time we get to the Second World War, the United States was so far in advance of every other country. Most of the world had been devastated by the war. The United States gained enormously from it. That it seemed that free trade might be a possible idea. That followed England's policy a century earlier. England had about twice the per capita capitalization of other countries, so they figured, okay, maybe we'll experiment with laissez-faire. If you're way ahead of everyone else, then free markets sound like a good idea because you're going to win in the competition. But just like England, the United States imposed very severe restrictions after the Second World War, as Britain had done. But there was a move up until then. There was not much pretense of being a market society. The protective tariffs enabled the United States to, and other measures, to set up a textile industry. That was the first stage in industrialization. Later in the century, a steel industry, barring superior British goods, just as Britain had barred superior Indian steel. Andrew Carnegie developed the first billion-dollar corporation around 1900, thanks to, first of all, very high protective tariffs, which kept out superior British goods, procurement by the state. It's a major form of public subsidy. He was a great pacifist, so he got huge contracts from the Navy, which was a great subsidy, and also just by straight violence. So the what's called the biggest strike in American history at Homestead, Pennsylvania, was a strike by the iron and steel workers, which was smashed by the Carnegie Corporation. At first they called in Pinkertons, later the National Guard, which destroyed it. It wasn't actually a strike, it was a lockout. The Carnegie Corporation announced that no union worker would be permitted to have a job. So if workers wanted to have a job, they had to apply individually. That led to a walkout and then the violence, which not only destroyed the union, but also the town and the region, which was worker-owned and worker-run. It was a kind of a workers' republic. It was a major event, Homestead strike, lockout. At the same time, of course, there were other major market interventions, aren't called that by economists, but cotton was, which was like the oil of the 19th century, fueled the Industrial Revolution. Now, that was not based on market principles. It was based on slavery, which is kind of a pretty severe interference with the market. Extermination of the native population was pretty remote from market principles, but was a prerequisite for developing an advanced economy. Those are the two major features of American history, and it's worth remembering that slavery almost never ended. Slavery was officially ended after the Civil War, and it lasted for about 10 years. After that, there was a North-South compact which permitted the former slave states to criminalize black life, which is essentially what they did. And if a black man was standing on a street corner, he could be charged with vagrancy. If he looked the wrong way, somebody claimed that a white woman, he could be charged with attempted rape. And pretty soon they had most of the black male population back in jail. Perfect labor force, and much better than slavery. In the case of slavery, you own the capital and you have to maintain it. In the case of criminalization, the state maintains the capital. You just get it free. And a large part of the American Industrial Revolution was based on that. That actually lasted until the Second World War, when there was a need for what was called free labor. Then you had a couple of decades of relative opportunities for African Americans that ended around 1980 with Reagan's racist drug war aimed at the black population, mainly black male population. By now we're back to criminalization of the black life. You take a look at the 500 years since the first slaves came, there's been about three or four decades of relative opportunities for African Americans. That's crucial part of our history, just as virtual extermination of the indigenous population is. A very severe market restrictions. I won't go through the rest of the story, but it continues without a break. After the Second World War, there was a huge increase in state intervention in the economy. Most of the modern economy, the high-tech economy, was developed in places like MIT under government funding, mostly Pentagon funding. By the time you get to the Reagan years, about a third of research and development was Pentagon funded, and about two-thirds of the research and development that were risky and creative were Pentagon funded. The way the whole IT revolution is based on that. Computers, internet, microelectronics, satellites, almost without exception, comes from decades of research and development, primarily in the state sector. The way the system works is the public pays the costs, usually under some pretext, like we're defending ourselves from the Russians or the Martians or someone. The public pays the costs for decades, risky, creative work, and when something comes out of it, it's handed over to private enterprise for marketing and profit. And notice this is radically anti-capitalist. In a capitalist system, if you make an investment, especially a risky and long-term investment, and after maybe 30 years, something comes out that can make a profit, you're supposed to make the profit. But that's not the way our system works. The public pays the costs for the risky, difficult, creative part, and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs market it and make the profit. That you can hardly imagine anything more radically anti-capitalist. In the modern period, it's gotten even more extreme. Since the 1970s, as you know, the economy has become increasingly dependent on financial institutions. Right before the last crash, almost half of corporate profits were coming from financial institutions. And when I say they're profits, you have to add a qualification. Now, the International Monetary Fund recently did a study of the six major U.S. banks, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and so on, and tried to estimate where their profits come from. And they concluded that virtually all their profits come from a government insurance policy. It's called informally too big to fail. That includes not only the bailouts, which are famous, but much more. So they get cheap credit. They get credit ratings from the credit agencies, which are inflated because the agencies know that if they get into trouble, the public's going to bail them out. The business press, Bloomberg News, tried to estimate the total amount of this, and they came up with a figure of about $83 billion a year of public subsidy to the big banks. That's just the biggest banks. Extended over the whole financial system, it's even more. I mean, again, it's hard to think of more extreme attacks on essential basic principles of capitalism. Now, there are alternatives possible. And they're interesting and important ones, quite alive, in fact. So, for example, I talked about U.S. Steel, first billion-dollar corporation. By the late 70s, the American steel industry was moving towards financialization, offshoring, and so on. And they began to shut down facilities. One of the biggest ones is Youngstown, Pennsylvania, a major steel town, Ohio. Major steel town. The town was built by the union and the workers in the steel industry, and the U.S. Steel decided to shut it down. The workers and the community made an effort to buy the plant, have it worker-owned, which probably would have been profitable for the corporation. But the standard procedure is for big multinationals to reject profitable initiatives for worker takeover for reasons of class consciousness. It's dangerous to allow working people to take over the plant. Go back to Homestead when Carnegie called in the National Guard to smash up the workers' movement. One of the charges against the workers was that workers were running the plant and not taking orders from management. And that's dangerous. Might be profitable, but it's very dangerous for pretty obvious reasons. That's why during CIO organizing in the 30s, when the CIO started moving to sit-down strikes, the corporations really got worried. And you know, New Deal reforms started getting instituted. The sit-down strikes are just one step before taking over the factory, kicking out the managers and saying, goodbye, we'll run it ourselves. That's serious, and we have a very high class-conscious business community, different from any other country in the world. It's one of the reasons why there's been such a violent and severe anti-labor history, quite different from other countries, Britain, Australia, others. When the Youngstown workers offered to take over the to buy the enterprises, U.S. Steel refused, finally went to the courts, and the steel companies prevailed. They were not permitted to buy it. The industries were destroyed. But they didn't give up at that point. The workers in Youngstown and the communities began to look for alternatives, and they began to develop what's by now a fairly substantial network of worker-owned enterprises around Cleveland, northern Ohio. Some of them were fairly substantial, working into the public sector institutions that were around, like universities and research institutes and so on. That's an option which is possible, and it could be a major option. So, for example, you remember a couple of years ago, Obama basically took over the auto industry. It was collapsing, so the public rescued it, the usual technique. But the public really pretty much owned the industry at one point, and there were options. But the option that was taken was to essentially pay the costs, turn it back to the original owners, maybe some different faces, but basically the class of the original owners, and have it continue to produce what it had been producing, automobiles. There were alternatives. One alternative was to turn it over to the workforce, have them run it the way they ran the Homestead plant back in 1890, and have it produce the things that the country needs, like high-speed rail, which is much more important than more cars in the street. If any of you drove here this evening, you know the reason why. But that option was not taken, was not considered. And that's basically our fault. That option could be considered if you had something like the mood and attitudes around Youngstown in the late 70s or around Homestead, Pennsylvania in the late 90s, the period of the most extreme steps towards democracy in American history were right about that time. It was mostly an agricultural country. The Farmers Alliance, based in Texas and spreading to Kansas and other such places, was a movement of radical farmers with very far-reaching goals. Eliminate the banks, the northeastern banks, run them themselves, cooperatives, marketing cooperatives, and so on. And they were finally smashed by force. By force, that's a crucial part of American history. They were trying to link up with the Knights of Labor, a major, huge labor organization, which had, again, pretty radical objectives. And one of their slogans was that those who own the mills ought to run them. Usual undercurrent, sometimes major current of labor struggles. Why should we have managers when we can run it by ourselves? Why have owners? Why not take it over? That's the great fear of really existing capitalism, that the working class might take over the industrial system, the general system, and run it themselves. Farmers Alliance was destroyed by force. The Knights of Labor were destroyed by force. During the progressive period, early 20th century, there were sort of reforms, but they were constrained. They were not going to permit labor organization. By the 1920s, the labor movement had been virtually smashed. Major work by one of the leading labor historians, David Montgomery, called The Fall of the House of Labor. He's talking about the 1920s. Did resurrect in the 30s, but then the counterattack started right away, and you know what the situation is now. Well, that is the D part of wrecked. What about democracy? It's the public is not sufficiently organized and active to permit these things to happen, the existing alternatives to be implemented on a large scale, and that can change. The late 19th century is an example, the 1930s, the resurrection of the labor movement, which spearheaded the New Deal reforms, is an example, and it can happen again, but these things don't happen by themselves. Well, a couple of words about the prospects. What are the prospects for RECT? Pretty dim, actually. It's predictable that the existing institutions, the existing institutional structure of really existing capitalist democracy are going to self-destruct. Almost inevitable. There are two major factors that should be right at the forefront of our attention, indicate why that's going to happen. One of them is environmental catastrophe. Environmental catastrophe is a predictable consequence of existing institutions. Anyone who's literate knows at this point, or should know, that unless most of the fossil fuels, maybe 80%, are left in the ground, we're essentially doomed. At the same time, the energy corporations are doing everything they can to extract every last drop of oil from the ground. ExxonMobil, the major one, recently announced that it's going to focus laser-like, the word that the business press used for it, focus laser-like on maximizing fossil fuel use because it's so profitable. Chevron, another major energy corporation, had a small sustainable energy program, probably mostly for PR reasons. They recently announced that they're closing it down, even though it's profitable. The reason is that fossil fuels are much more profitable. And so it is across the board. You can't criticize the CEOs of the energy corporations for doing this. This is actually their legal obligation. Their legal obligation is to maximize profit for shareholders. And, of course, huge bonuses for themselves, which is designed by state power, but that's something on the side. If they don't do it, they'll be replaced by someone else who will do it. It's institutional logic. That to the extent that we have, to an extent, there is a capitalist market system, and to that extent, it's sufficient to drive the society towards destruction. And you don't have to look far to see it. Take this morning's newspapers, if you had a chance to look at them. The New York Times this morning has a front page story on the Australian heat wave, a huge heat wave in Australia last summer. It's been carefully studied by climate scientists pursuing various models of climate change. There was a report today showing that all of the models, no matter how they were based, came with the same conclusion, that there's no possible way for this heat wave to have developed except through global warming. It's one of the first cases where a specific climate disaster can be traced very clearly to what's plainly happening. That's the New York Times. The Boston Globe had a front page story, their lead story, on the fact that Boston is predicted to be under 7 or 8 feet of water by the end of the century. A couple of feet, maybe 2 or 3 feet in 20 years or so. And discussed various plans to do something about it. So like turning downtown Boston into something like Venice, replacing the streets by canals so you can replace your cars by canoes or something. And it pointed out that the process is irreversible, so we might as well be trying to face it somehow. Well, that is, and of course, that's the north. When you go to, say, Bangladesh, coastal plain, that means that tens of millions of people get wiped out. It's clearly coming. Everyone can see it. It's based on the logic of our institutions. Unless there's significant change, and not in the distant future, the prospects look pretty dim. Well, all of that should be pretty obvious to everyone. Unfortunately, it isn't. but it should be, and major efforts have to be made to make it obvious. But there's something else which is equally dangerous, maybe even more so, which is much less discussed, and that's the threat of nuclear war. If you look over the history of the nuclear interactions, it's a miracle that we've survived, literally. There's been case after case where we came within a hair's breadth of a nuclear war that would have wiped out organized life on Earth. That's what happens if there's a major nuclear war. So just to mention one case, which leads right up to the present, there's many, but in the early 1980s, when the Reagan administration came in, one of their first policies was to try to probe Russian air and naval defenses by simulated nuclear attacks to try to elicit a response and to see what they could learn about what the Russian preparations were. So they simulated attacks, nuclear attacks on Russia by sea and by air. Well, they were designed so the Russians could pick them up, otherwise there's no point. They wanted to find out the reaction. Well, they did pick them up. Russia happens to be pretty vulnerable, and they were worried about it. It was known, this was remembered, a very tense period. The Reagan administration was just placing the Pershing 2 missiles in Western Europe, which have a few minutes flight time to Moscow. That's kind of dangerous. These are nuclear missiles, of course. It was known at the time that the Russians were kind of worried. Recent revelations from the Russian archives have shown that they were extremely concerned, that they thought that a major nuclear attack was imminent and were readying themselves for a preemptive response, which would have wiped out the United States, basically. Actually, there are recent studies by the intelligence community warning and saying that the war scare was for real. It wasn't a joke. Well, right in the midst of all of this, we've recently learned the Russian automated response systems, they have them just like we do. There's a much worse, no doubt. And ours make plenty of errors, which are aborted by human intervention. Their systems provided warnings of a nuclear attack that was underway. The protocol is for the automated evidence to be handed over to the military command, who will then launch a preemptive or maybe at that point reactive nuclear attack. It's handed over by a human being, a man whose name was Stanislav Petrov. He just decided not to turn it over. That's why we're here today to talk about it. Literally, one Russian technician decided to disobey orders, and we're alive to talk about it. That's one incident of many. Well, a couple of years after that, the Berlin Wall fell, Soviet Union collapsed, and a very critical period in American history took place. For 50 years, NATO had been established on the principle that it had to defend Western Europe from the Russian hordes. Okay, now, no more Russian hordes. So what happens to NATO? Well, if you'd believed any of the propaganda of the past 50 years, NATO should have dissolved. It didn't. It expanded. It expanded to become essentially the U.S. intervention force. It has now an official mandate not to protect us from the Russians, an official mandate to control the global energy system, sea lanes and pipelines, and to intervene wherever the master in Washington orders it to intervene, which has happened over and over. That's NATO. The Gorbachev, Russian leader at the time, made an astonishing offer. He offered to allow Germany to be unified and to join a hostile military alliance, NATO. If you look at the history of the recent years, you can see how astonishing that offer was. I mean, Germany alone had virtually destroyed Russia several times with tens of millions of people killed, huge casualties, when Russia was more or less backed by the West. Now he was saying Germany can join a hostile military alliance and be remilitarized. There was a condition, quid pro quo. The condition was, as the phrasing was, that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. That meant to East Germany. NATO would not move to East Germany. That was the condition. There was an agreement between Gorbachev and President Bush and James Baker, Secretary of State. Immediately, NATO was expanded to the east, to East Germany. Gorbachev was, of course, infuriated, but he was informed by Washington that it was just a gentleman's agreement. There was nothing on paper, so he had no basis for complaint. They didn't say it, but it means if you're stupid enough to accept our word, that's your problem. Then Clinton comes in and expands NATO to the whole Eastern European region bordering on Russia. Russians are a little unhappy about that, just as if, say, the Warsaw Pact were to take over Canada and Mexico. Might not like it. In fact, very quickly be a nuclear war if there was even a hint of that. Now, NATO is threatening to move to the Ukraine. That's the heartland of the Russian system. Not only long historic connections, but from a strategic point of view, inconceivable that any Russian leader would accept it. Certainly, that's not just my view. You can read in the major establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, their lead article this month is by a well-known international relations specialist, John Mearsheimer. The headline title is something like, "The West is responsible for the Ukraine crisis." And what he describes is essentially this, efforts to move Western power, meaning U.S. power, right to the heartland of Russian strategic concerns is guaranteed to elicit a strong Russian response, just again, independently of who's running the place. It's run by Condi. They'd have the same reaction. Well, that's it's leading to the threat of a nuclear confrontation. And to make it clearer, not only the rhetoric, but the actions in the West are pressing in that direction, the Russians also. So Obama, who came into office, you remember, if you can remember, a couple of years ago as a peace candidate who was going to move towards elimination of nuclear weapons, they recently announced that a trillion dollars program, to upgrade and modernize U.S. nuclear weapons forces. Russians noticed that, we're encroaching right into the core strategic areas for them. That's playing with fire, and you can't be certain that there'll be a Stanislav Petrov to save our skins next time. Well, those are the, and all of this derives directly from the logic of institutions. In really existing capitalist democracy, the state is dedicated to maximizing its power and the power, the welfare of its primary constituents, corporate sector. It's no secret. You read international relations theory, you learn a principle that states are committed to security. What is not asked is security for whom? It's certainly not security for the population, as even these few examples illustrate. That's obviously the case. It is security. It's security for state power and for the primary constituency of state power, private concentrated wealth. And that logic is driving us towards a situation where destruction is not unlikely and increasingly likely. Well, those are the prospects for wrecked, and they cannot be permitted to persist just for the, even for the decent survival of the species.
We have time for a few questions, if there are any questions.
The bank tell us that they paid back the bailouts, so I don't understand
I suppose I lend you $100, and a couple of years later, you pay me back $100.
Oh, yeah.
Who lost?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But furthermore, the bailouts are a very small part of the public subsidy. When the business press uses IMF figures to estimate $83 billion a year of subsidy, they're not talking about the bailouts. They're talking about other things, that some of which I mentioned, like cheap credit, access to cheap credit, higher credit ratings, inflated credit ratings, which give you all kind of options, because the credit agencies understand that there's a government insurance policy. These guys are going to be bailed out if they get into trouble, so we can give them higher credit ratings. It also means many other things. If you're, say, Goldman Sachs, you can make a risky transaction. Risky transactions tend to make high profits, but they also carry the possibility of failure. But you don't have to worry about it, right? Because you guys are going to pay them if they get into trouble. That's a government insurance policy. If you had an insurance policy like that, you could do all sorts of things. but you do give the banks that insurance policy. As I said, the IMF figures lead to an estimate of $83 billion a year. You could argue the details, but something on that order. And they say that's essentially all the profits of the big banks. And that has enormous consequences. Like, one of the consequences is what's called the systemic risk. There's a risk. Oh, if Goldman Sachs makes a risky transaction and it happens to fail, it might bring down the whole system. We saw that a couple of years ago when Lehman went. It looked like the whole thing was going to collapse. Well, there's a protection against systemic risk, namely you. You pay for it and guarantee it's not going to happen. And that just increases risky behavior and the likelihood of crashes, like what we're now seeing. Now, these are all pretty serious problems. They're not at the level of climate catastrophe and nuclear war. Those are kind of colossal dangers. But these are pretty serious dangers. The public really suffered from the latest financial collapse, the financial housing bubble and collapse. A lot of people are still suffering from it. Actually, there was congressional legislation. Speaking of bailouts, the bailouts came from congressional legislation. But that congressional legislation had two parts to it. One was bail out the criminals. The other was help the people who were their victims, protect them from foreclosures and so on. Which part of the bargain was kept? Well, it's not a secret. The Inspector General of the Justice Department, Neil Barofsky, was screaming about it. I wrote a book about it. But that's really existing capitalist democracy. That's the way it works. That's its logic. So, yeah, they sort of paid back kind of the actual bailout, but that's a joke. And in fact, what's happening now is just mind-boggling. The world's biggest insurance company, AIG, was on the verge of collapse, and the government essentially bought it and bailed it out. Now it's richer than ever. I wasn't just going to knock out AIG, so Goldman Sachs, for example, was heavily involved in risky loans guaranteed by AIG. If AIG went down, Goldman Sachs would go down, and so on across the board. But you guys stepped in and saved it all. Right after that, after it was rescued from having virtually brought down the international economy, AIG gave expanded bonuses to its chief executives. Now, that caused a little bit of controversy. How come they're, after these guys practically destroy the economy and we pay them off, they decide to give themselves bonuses? Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, Obama's, you know, one of his chief advisors, responded to that saying, well, we just don't have any choice. It's a contractual obligation, and we believe in contractual obligations, so we're just forced to accept it. At the very same time, the state of Illinois was refusing to pay pensions to public service workers because they said they didn't have enough money. Was that a contractual obligation?
Yes.
Not only that, I mean, the workers had already paid for it. When you have a pension, it's because you take lower wages. That's a bargain that's made. But that contractual obligation, which workers already paid for, that one didn't have to be on it. And we're back to the logic of RECT again. AIG executives, yeah, of course, they have to get a huge bonus after practically destroying us. Teachers, firemen, and so on, they don't deserve that kind of thing. That's their, what George Orwell once called unpeople, as distinct from people. So they, no contractual obligations there. That's our commitment to capitalist principles. What's happening now is beyond grotesque. The former CEO of AIG, Maurice Greenberger, is now, he's the principal in a court suit, Star International versus U.S. government. It's going to the Supreme Court right now. He's complaining that the bonuses weren't, that the payout to AIG wasn't big enough. And he wants to be reimbursed for costs to AIG.
No,
that's, you know, if anybody asks you for the definition of chutzpah, you can mention it. That's in the Supreme Court right now. And, you know, given the nature of the court, it's not so easy to figure out how it'll turn out, even though, I mean, this is like beyond insanity, except under the logic of really existing capitalist democracy. That's the story of the bailouts.
You've been critical of real existing capitalist democracy. Are you saying that without the real existing part, that capitalist democracy would be better?
No, I'm not. I started by saying that one of the relations between capitalism and democracy is contradiction. You can't have capitalist democracy. And the people who really sort of believe in markets, or at least pretend to understand that, so if you read Milton Friedman and other apostles of so-called libertarianism, they don't call for democracy. They call for what they call freedom, which is a very restrictive concept of freedom. It's not the freedom of a working person to control their work, their lives, and so on. It's their freedom to submit themselves to control by a higher authority. That's called freedom, but not democracy. They don't like democracy, and they're right. Capitalism and democracy really are inconsistent. Actually, what's called libertarianism in the United States is about as extreme an example of anti-libertarianism that you can imagine. They're in favor of private tyranny, the worst kind of tyranny, tyranny by unaccountable private concentrations of wealth. When they say, we don't want government interference in the market, they mean that. They mean, maybe they don't understand it, but if you think it through, it's pretty obvious. The kind of interference in the market they want to block is the kind that would permit unconstrained tyranny on the part of totally unaccountable private tyrannies, which is what corporations are. It's worth bearing in mind how radically opposed this is to classical liberalism. Now, they like to invoke, say, Adam Smith, but if you read Adam Smith, he said the opposite. He's famous for not, you know, the claim is that he was opposed to regulation, government regulation, interference in markets. Not true. He was in favor of regulation, as he put it, when it benefits the working man. He was against interference when it benefited the masters. That's traditional classical liberalism. This, what's called libertarian in the United States, which likes to invoke the history that they've concocted, is radically opposed to basic class libertarian principles. And it's kind of astonishing to me that a lot of young people, say college students, are attracted by this kind of thing. I mean, you can, after all, read the classical texts. So take, say, Adam Smith. I mean, Adam Smith at the time, he's the icon, you know, of liberty. He was considered to be a dangerous radical at the time because he was pretty anti-capitalist, this pre-capitalist era, but he was opposed to it. He condemned what he called the vile maxim of the masters of mankind, all for ourselves and nothing for anyone else. That's an abomination. Take the phrase invisible hand, everybody's learned that in high school or college. Adam Smith actually did use the term, rarely, but take a look at how he used it. In Wealth of Nations, his major work, it's used once. If you look at the context, it's an argument against what is now called neoliberal globalization. And what he argued is this. He was concerned with England, of course. He said, suppose in England that the merchants and manufacturers invested abroad and imported from abroad. He said, well, that would be profitable for them, but would be harmful to the people of England. However, they will have enough of a commitment to their own country, to England, what's called a home bias in the literature. They'll have enough of a home bias so that, as if by an invisible hand, they'll keep to the less profitable actions and England will be saved from the ravages of what we call neoliberal globalization. That's the one use of the term in Wealth of Nations. In his other major work, Moral Sentiments, terms also used once. And the context is this. Remember, England's basically an agricultural country then. He says, suppose some landlord accumulates an enormous amount of land and everybody else has to work for him. He says, well, that won't turn out too badly. And the reason is that the landlord will be motivated by his natural sympathy for other people. So he will make sure that the necessities of life and the goods available will be distributed equitably to the people on his lands, and it'll end up with an equal, relatively equal and just distribution of wealth, as if by an invisible hand. And that's his other use of the term. Just compare that with what you're taught in school or what you read in the newspaper. And it goes across the board, like everybody probably has read the first paragraphs of Wealth of Nations, which talks about how wonderful it is that the butcher pursues his interests and the baker pursues his interests. We're all happy. So we should be in favor of a division of labor. Everybody's read that. How many people have read a couple of hundred pages into Wealth of Nations, where he has a bitter attack on division of labor for interesting reasons, and reasons that were standard in the Enlightenment environment in which he lived, very different from ours. He says if he pursued division of labor, people will be directed to actions in which they'll just repeat the same mechanical operations over and over. They'll be de-skilled. Okay, that's the goal of management for 100 years, de-skill the workforce. He says, that's what will happen if you pursue division of labor. He goes on to say, this will turn people into creatures as stupid and ignorant as a human being can possibly be. And therefore, in any civilized society, the government will have to intervene to prevent any development like this. Now, that's Adam Smith's view of division of labor. The next step, here's a research project, take the standard edition, scholarly edition of Wealth of Nations, produced by the University of Chicago Press, naturally, on the bicentennial, with a scholarly apparatus, you know, footnotes and everything else, and take a look at the index. This is a scholarly index. Look up Division of Labor. This part of the book is not referenced. You can't find it unless you decide to read 700 pages. Then you can find it. But that's his concept of division of labor. And it continues like this. I mean, I'm not extolling, you know, a lot of things that are you can harshly criticize, like his advice to the colonies. But nevertheless, it's a very different picture from what's called libertarianism or capitalism today. Capitalist democracy would self-destruct. Capitalism would self-destruct. And that's why it hasn't been instituted. The masters understand that they cannot survive a capitalist economy, laissez-faire economy. And you take a look at the history, it's pretty interesting. So the United States, when it was independent, so it could reject the rules of sound economics and develop. There were other countries that were poised for industrial revolution and were given the same advice, like Egypt and India. In fact, India already was the commercial industrial center of the world, more so than England. Egypt was poised for an industrial revolution. And it's not impossible that it might have developed. It was a rich agrarian society. It had cotton, produced cotton. As I say, that's the main product, like oil today. And it didn't need slaves. It had peasants. It had a developmental government aimed at industrial development. It could have taken off, just as India could have taken off. But they were not free to reject sound economics because they were ruled by British force. So they were forced to accept sound economics. And Egypt became Egypt, and the United States became the United States. India went through a century of de-development until it finally got independence. That's what happens when you apply laissez-faire principles. In fact, that's essentially how the Third World and the First World divided. You take a look at the countries that developed. They're the countries who violated the principles. England, the United States, Germany, France, Netherlands. One country of the South, one country developed, Japan, the one country that wasn't colonized and was able to pursue the same course that the rich countries developed. I mentioned that in mid-19th century, 1846, Britain was so far ahead of the rest of the world in industrial development that they did decide that laissez-faire would be possible. So they moved to what's called the free trade era. First of all, they imposed sharp constraints on it. They cut off the India. India was not allowed to, others could not invest in India, their main possession. And India was not allowed to develop. And there were other restrictions. But pretty soon, the British capitalists called the game off because they couldn't compete. And by the 1920s, they couldn't compete with the Japanese production. So they literally closed off the empire to Japanese exports. That's part of the background for the Pacific War in the 1940s. The United States did the same with its smaller empire, the Philippines. The Dutch did the same with Indonesia. All the imperial systems decided no more free trade, we can't compete. So they closed off the empire, meaning Japan had no markets, no resources, and they went to war. That's a large part of the background. The United States in 1945 did move towards laissez-faire. In fact, there was an important conference. The United States was basically running the world at that point, you know, for obvious reasons. There was a hemispheric conference called by Washington, February 1945 in Mexico, where the Western Hemisphere was compelled to adopt an economic charter for the Americas, which banned any interference with market principles. The goal was, you read the State Department reports, to oppose the new nationalism in Latin America, which is based on the idea that the resources, that the people of a country should benefit from the country's resources. That's evil. Can't allow that. It's Western and U.S. investors who have to benefit from their resources. So that was the Economic Charter of the Americas imposed on the countries of the hemisphere, with one exception, here. The United States did not follow those policies. quite the contrary. As I mentioned, there was a massive development of a state-based economy with an industrial policy, the kind that created the modern high-tech economy. You can see it right across the river. Take a look at MIT, right? One of the main centers of this. If you looked at MIT in the 1950s, when I got there, it was surrounded by electronics-based high-tech firms like Raytheon and iTech, you know, huge IT firms. You take a look at MIT today, take a look at the buildings. It's Novartis, Pfizer, and so on. The reason is completely obvious. During the 50s and the 60s, the cutting edge of the economy was electronics-based. So the way to get the public to pay for it was to scream Russians and to get them to pay higher taxes for the Pentagon. And then the Pentagon would fund the research and development, like my own salary, for example. I shouldn't complain too much. And and of course, private, so-called private industry was around there like vultures to pick up the products and the research and just market it. Well, since the 70s, the cutting edge of the economy has been moving towards being biology-based. So funding, government funding has shifted. Pentagon funding is declining. Funding from the NIH and other so-called health-related government institutions is increasing. And the private corporations understand that. So now Novartis, you know, genetic engineering firms and so on are hanging around trying to pick up the research that you're paying for so that they can market it and make profits. It's just transparent. It's in front of our eyes. And it takes a very effective educational system to prevent people from seeing it. It's virtually transparent. That's the way really existing capitalist democracy works. I'll say a final word about democracy, and then I'm afraid I have to leave. There's a major attack on democracy all the way through. And by now it's reached the point which is pretty remarkable. I mean, you take a look at one of the main topics in mainstream political science, you know, I'm not talking about radicals, mainstream political science is comparing public attitudes with public policy. It's a fairly straightforward, you know, hard work, but straightforward effort. We have the public policy, so you can see it. There's extensive polling, quite reliable generally, consistent in its results. It gives you a good sense of what public attitudes are. And the results of this are published in the major books and articles, give you references if you like. The results are very straightforward. About 70% of the population, the lowest 70% on the income scale, are literally disenfranchised. Their opinions have no effect on policy. Their elected representatives don't pay any attention to them. That's one of the reasons why many of them don't bother voting. They're not going to pay attention to them anyway. You may not read the technical literature, but you understand it in other ways. As you move up the income scale, you begin to get a little more influence on policy. When you get to the top, and contrary to the Occupy movement, it's not 1%. It's more like 0.1%. When you get to the top, where the massive concentration of wealth is, they basically set policy. That's not democracy, that's plutocracy. And that's what we have accepted. And the good thing about it is it's changeable. It's not controlled by force. We are very free in that respect, thanks to victories over the centuries. It's not possible now for a corporation to do what Andrew Carnegie, the great pacifist, did in 1890. That gives a lot of options, and you have to make use of them.